Please be seated. The third case for oral argument this morning is on the matter of the adoption of AAB and BAB for the appellant, State of South Dakota Department of Social Services. We have Mr. Joseph N. Thronson, a Special Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. And for the appellees T and TH, we have Ms. Catherine Morrison, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Thronson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Joe Thronson. I'm appearing today on behalf of the South Dakota Department of Social Services. What the department is asking the court to do today is to reverse a circuit court decision that allowed the petitioners to file a petition to adopt two children who were in the department's custody. In this case, the case before the court today involves two children who were siblings and who came into custody of the department at different times. Because of that, they were placed in different homes. The first child, AAB, was placed with the petitioners. When the second child, BAB, came into custody, that child was placed with another foster family, the Hummelvicks. What this case is really about is who has standing, the ability to address the issue of what is in the best interest of a child. Because, as this court has said on many occasions, adoption is a creature of statute. Any rights or any ability must come from statute. Because South Dakota statutes do not give petitioners a specific right to be heard on the issue of what's in the children's best interest, then they do not have standing. Additionally, because this case involves the interpretation of because adoption is a creature of statute, this case involves the interpretation of several statutes and should properly be reviewed de novo today. The circuit court's initial finding was that petitioners had standing to file their own petition to adopt these two children based primarily on three statutes. 25.6.2, which is a general statute which says any person may adopt any child. 25.6.11, which talks about a party giving notice to the Department of Social Services and its response. And the court also mentioned SDCL 25.5.29, which has popularly been come to known as Timmy's Law, which deals with a party other than a biological parent getting custody of a child. And I'll go through these statutes in order. First, 25.6.2 is a statute of general applicability. It applies to statutes in general. The circuit court found that because the language of the statute provided any person may adopt any child, this gave petitioners standing. However, what the circuit court failed to do is to recognize several other statutes which would limit the applicability of this general statute to children in the department's custody. First, SDCL 26-8A-27 specifically grants the department legal custody of any child whose parents' rights have been terminated through an ANN. And with the legal custody should come the ability to decide ultimately where those children end up.
Well, but wait a minute. I mean, there's lots of people, or not lots of people. There's other entities that have legal custody, but that doesn't give them the right to determine who ultimately might be the best person to adopt. I mean, private agencies have legal custody. They don't get to make the decision.
I guess I can't speak to private entities. All I can say is that the department is in a unique position because we, the department, receives custody of children who have been subject to abuse and neglect. And it, through statute, it's our responsibility to find a permanent home for those children.
Okay, but the standard is the best interest of the child, is it not?
The standard is best interest of the child.
So doesn't the court make that decision under the general? This case is just about standing. Who gets to? We aren't deciding the ultimate adoption issue. It's just who goes to court. And under your theory, the department gets to make the ultimate decision on the adoption?
I wouldn't say the department gets the... the department recognizes the court makes the ultimate decision. But, and I cited several cases from other jurisdictions in my brief.
Unless the statute is exactly the same, it doesn't matter, you know. So how does that fit within our statutory scheme?
I don't believe that finding in the best interest of the I don't believe that the circuit court should, or the statutes provide the circuit court the ability to give a party standing who otherwise wouldn't have it simply by trying to bootstrap it to, well, it's in the best interest of a child for the court to allow someone else to maybe be considered. Third, under the third statute that limits 2562's applicability is 25612, which talks about the parties whose consent is necessary in any adoption. And in the case, the adoption of DM, this court specifically found that when dealing with a child in the custody of the department, it was the department was in fact a party whose consent was necessary for such an adoption. The circuit court also found that 25611 meant that petitioners had standing to file their own petition and essentially relegated the department's role in any adoption to simply that of giving its advice as to whether such an adoption was permissible or was a good idea or not. And the department contends that the circuit court's reading of 25611 contradicts not only the reading of that statute contradicts these other statutes, which would limit its applicability, but would also lead to an absurd result. And because of this, there's an ambiguity, and it's therefore necessary to consider the statute or the legislative history of 25611. And if one considers the legislative history of the statute, what one will find is that in its previous form, that statute had nothing to do with whether or not the department's would be take or the department's role as having the ability to deny consent would be taken out of this bill. What 25611 previously dealt with prior to being amended in 2007 was instances where essentially even private adoption agencies had to send a report to the department and get the department's opinion as to whether a certain adoption would be advisable or not. And what the legislature said in 2007 was, you know, we want to streamline the private adoption process. And it really doesn't make any sense that the department is giving an opinion on cases in which they've never had children in custody. So what the legislature intended to do was to strip out all reference to the department giving an opinion on private adoptions. And if one considers the name of the bill and listens to the testimony on this particular bill, it's clear that they never considered the issue of whether or not this was actually going to remove the department's ability to not consent to adoptions regarding children in its custody.
You know, we don't go to legislative history when the words of the statute are plain, and Section 11 says that the department gets to make a recommendation. It doesn't say they have a veto power.
Well, I would agree, Justice Hinter, that it does say the department gets to make a recommendation, but I don't think the statute necessarily says that that recommendation isn't binding regarding children in its custody, and it's not
the... So you're saying that whatever recommendation the department makes is binding on the court?
I'm not saying that whatever determination is binding.
I think you just did.
Well, if I could clarify, what I think the statutes contemplate is that in the event, as in this case, where the department has chosen a good home for children to go to, the legislature didn't intend that the circuit court would second-guess that decision because it's not in the children's best interest.
So you're saying that the Department of Social Services makes the ultimate decision, not the court?
And the judge simply rubber stamps the order when it comes through?
No, it's not an issue of rubber stamping. It's an issue of really, I guess it's a question of would the court have reason to question the department's decision?
All now, the time. That's their function, isn't that?
But, well, that's correct. But in practice, I don't know that the court, that circuit courts routinely do that. I think it's understood, it's implied that when the department comes forward and says, we think that this family is a good placement for a child, that the courts defer to that decision. Now, that's not to say that if there's something, patently wrong with the decision, or if, say, the department's not following the law in terms of getting a home study is delaying, that the circuit court can't question that. But I don't think the statutes or the legislature really ever intended that the circuit court would say, yes, you have a good DSS, you picked a good family, but I think this other family might be better, so therefore we're going to draw this out so that I can decide whether the two are better.
Well, counsel, the court wouldn't make that determination, either relatives or, as in the present case, foster parents would seek to be designated as the potential adoptive family. So it wouldn't just be the department making the selection, but others who want to be considered would come forward and petition the court. And can you just say a couple of words about how the process works now? There's an adoption conference call. Can you say briefly how the process works now?
The way the process works now, there is, after parental rights have been terminated and after the necessary appeal period has run, or if appeal has happened, that the case is affirmed, the department, different members of the department, usually people from the local office, wherever the child came from, adoption specialists and peer, and sometimes even foster parents will come together and they'll talk about the different choices. They have a conference call and they decide we think it's best for the child to go here or wherever.
Did that happen in this case?
It did.
Both foster parents?
I off the top of my head, I cannot remember, Justice, if both foster parents. I mean, the appellates clearly were aware that this meeting took place. And in this case, they didn't agree with the decision, so they filed their own petition. So after the conference call, basically, if there's no relative preference, then it goes to the circuit court, and the circuit court agree, and the circuit court either signs off or says no. However, Justice Kern, when you talk about rubber stamping, as it is now, I don't know that the courts routinely second guess the department's decision.
Do and they I don't, have the power to do so?
If they have good reason to do so, I believe they do. But again, it's a question of, even if they do, who has standing to bring the question before the court? I guess in this case, the question is, had petitioners never stepped forward, would the original A&N judge in this case have on their own thought, let's stop and look at this? And unfortunately, that's a bell we can't unring in this case because petitioners did bring it forward. They filed their own petition. They brought it before a judge who had no connection to the case prior to hearing the adoption hearing. So therefore, it's not even a case where really we could go back and say, let's just do it over and let the judge decide, because that issue has already impermissibly been interjected in the case. Because adoption is a creature of statute, it's important to look at if the right to challenge the department decision is found in statute, then it's important to look at who exactly does have that right. And the statutes do, in fact, provide one group of people with the right. In 2005, the legislature passed two statutes which provided relatives of any child brought to the department into the department's custody with a limited right to challenge that decision if they did not get custody of that child. However, even that right was not absolute. They only can intervene within an ANN. And in the adoption of DM, which I think both parties here have kind of talked about that as DM1 and DM2, in the second DM case, this court specifically said that relatives cannot rely on the adoption statutes to gain custody of a child. They have to intervene in an ANN. So what the circuit court's decision leaves us with is a situation where a party who is not specifically named in statute actually has more rights than a party who was listed, that being relatives, because relatives have a right, but they can only intervene in an ANN, whereas any other person who's not a relative could simply file their own petition. And this creates an illogical situation. It's illogical to think that the legislature would intend to actually, by granting relatives a specific right, would be actually meaning to give them less rights than what they'd have if they had just petitioned as any person.
Is it illogical, or is it based on the difference between a case where the ANN proceeding has not been finished in a case where the terminations are done and it's a matter of placement?
That's a very good question, Justice Inter, and I have to say that I think that's an issue that we've struggled with from the beginning in this case, is when exactly does the ANN end? Because the circuit court did rule that, well, these DM and its case law is inapplicable because petitioners aren't intervening, they're filing their own petition. But the department would contend that it's essentially a distinction without a difference, because the ANN court continues to have jurisdiction of this case. The original ANN judge is still holding regular 6-month review hearings, and the child is still in the department's custody. So really, everything about this case, the department has been involved and has had custody, and to draw an arbitrary line and say, okay, because TPR has happened, we're going to just cut this off and consider the ANN over, I don't think that we can really do this in this case, because, you know, adoptions, the process takes some time. And if we want to say that once TPR happens, that means the adoption is over, that the ANN is over, and therefore, you know, it's anybody's game, I think that creates some problems too, because, you know, essentially that means anyone who really wants to file an adoption, you know, can be waiting at the courthouse, and before the ink on the order is even dry, they can start filing their own petitions and say, well, ANN is over, so we should be able to adopt.
Isn't the trial court uniquely qualified to make that type of a best interest determination? You can bring those in who wish to adopt the child, and the trial court will hear the evidence if there are multiple options for the child and make a best interest determination.
Justice Kern, I would say that it is the trial court's duty, and I guess depending on where in the state a court is located, I mean, some courts obviously have more experience with ANN than others. They do have that right. However, I think also this court has recognized that when it comes to children who are abused or subject to abuse and neglect, that the department is in a unique position to deal with those children. And really, what the courts do is they rely on the department's judgment for these cases. And that's not to say that they couldn't ever question us, but I think it's telling that in the vast majority of cases where someone doesn't try and interject and intervene and file their own petition, that the circuit courts don't question the department's ability.
You have just under 2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Justice. I think what the most important thing to keep in mind here is that the reason the legislature limited who had the ability to be heard on this issue is because allowing all kinds of people to simply throw their hat in the ring is not in the best interest of the children in the department's custody. Essentially, what the circuit court's ruling does is it creates a free-for-all, where basically any person who decides that they want to adopt a child and they think might have a good chance can simply file their own petition. Therefore, in that event, the court then will have to entertain multiple different adoption petitions. In this case, we had one set of parents file a petition, and it's already delayed this case beyond where we wanted it to go by over a year.
Yeah, but you're the one that's appealing it.
That's correct.
You're complaining about a delay, but you're causing the delay.
Well, we're causing a... That is correct, Justice Severson. However, you know, thinking about cases in the future, the circuit court's ruling gives any party who wants to throw their hat in the ring, essentially, the ability to come forward, and if they don't like the decision, then they could file their own petition, or they could appeal. And additionally, this case was complicated by the fact that now the other foster family has filed their own petition and got their own attorney. So really, there's, without reaffirming the department's ability to make these decisions without parties not having standing, I mean, there's no end to the litigation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thornton. Ms. Morrison, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, excuse me, opposing counsel, Catherine Morrison for the appellees, Twyla and Troy Hansen. To this court, the trial court correctly concluded that the Hansons have standing to bring petitions for adoption of the minor children in question without the consent of the Department of Social Services. The Hansons respectfully request the lower court's ruling be affirmed at this time. Now, if I may, I'd like to provide a little bit more of the factual background because I do believe it goes to Mr. Thronson's argument. First, AAB was born September 3rd, 2012. The child was placed then with the Hansons on January 8th, 2013. The second child was born October 16th, 2013. It appears that the child went straight from the hospital to the second family. The parents' rights were terminated in May of 2014. Now, as of the January 2015 petition by the Hansons, there really wasn't much that the department had done to take significant steps to move these children. And I do believe that goes to Mr. Thronson's delay argument. Now, the real question here, as the court posed, is whether the Hansons have the ability to bring petitions for adoption through South Dakota Chapter 25-6. It's fairly clear in the adoption is mentioned multiple times throughout South Dakota codified laws in various chapters. However, in specifically Chapter 25-6, we see the mention of children in the department's custody on multiple fronts. First, 25-6-4 subpoint 6. It mentions parents of children to be adopted whose parental rights have been judicially terminated. We also see 25-6-9.1, the discussion of home study and how that relates to children in the care and custody of the department. Now, most notably, in SDCL 25-6-11, the court references that the Department of Social Services shall provide a recommendation when we're dealing with the adoption of a child in the department's custody. I pause here and ask the court to look at the plain language of this statute. The department cannot point to one statute that says the circuit court must adhere to the department's recommendation. Further, unlike other jurisdictions mentioned by Mr. Thronson in his brief to this court, we have no specific law that mandates consent from the department or guardian in order to adopt a child. I would then direct the court to 25-6-4. That gives the court the ability to waive the consent of the biological parent. Now, it is the argument of the department today that they hold more power than the biological parent. Essentially, the circuit court may make a determination if a biological parent's right should be waived, but it cannot question the department. I would argue that this is both illogical and unreasonable. It does not appear that this was the legislature's intent behind this set of statutes. Next, I would ask the court to look to the plain meaning of SDCL 25-6-2. Essentially, if a party is at least 10 years older than the child to be adopted, that gives them standing. Now, this statute also mentions that the court is to consider the best interest of the child. Case closed. The Hansons are at least 10 years older than both children. The children are eligible for adoption. Therefore, the Hansons have standing to bring this action. Now, the circuit court, according to 25-6-6, has the jurisdiction to make any determination as it relates to adoption. Therefore, the department still has the ability to come forth and provide the circuit court with the reasoning behind its recommendation.
What does the circuit court do with the second petition that counsel just referred to by another would-be set of parents.
Thank you, Justice Gilbertson. Judge Hoffman did give us direction in his memorandum opinion that the Hummelvigs could bring their own petition for BAB, and then he stated he would then consolidate the actions for purposes of judicial efficiency. And I would like to address this point head-on, and that being that Mr. Thronson's argument that people can essentially just wait outside the courthouse to adopt these children. That's not true for many reasons, and I would also argue it's not a unique argument to adoptions for children in DSS custody. Frivolous actions is an argument that can be made in any realm of the law, not just DSS adoptions. You could make the same argument for private adoptions. However, this does not appear to be occurring, and that is because 25.6 includes additional statutory language which limits the ability of the individual who can come and file for adoption. One of, I believe, the most important, 25.6.9, stating that the parties must live with the child for at least 6 months before the adoption. Therefore, this idea that anyone can throw their hat in the ring simply isn't true because they don't adhere to these statutes.
Well, since you brought it up, it's a little early to get to the six-month period because this is really an issue of standing. But I assume that's something that some court is going to have to deal with at some point in the 6 months. Is that correct, that the six-month residency?
It is something that the court will have to deal with, and I wholeheartedly agree with Judge Hoffman's analysis on Timmy's Law, also known as SDCL 25-529. Specifically, and I think Judge Hoffman made a great point about 25-529, that being this holding is keeping with the clearly articulated public policy of the state of South Dakota as expressed in legislation set forth that this court of this state shall be open to claims by qualified adults, particularly those who have served in a caretaker role and to whom the child has formed a significant bond, that the child's best interests are served by awarding custody to them. The legislature has recognized that, and that is something that a judge sitting on this matter would have to consider. It is the argument of the department that the Hansons don't have standing for multiple reasons. One being because they don't have the consent of the department, as I have addressed. Two, because they are not interested parties in the abuse and neglect case. Now, as this court has told, informed us in Wang v. Wang, standing is established by being an interested party. And the test for an interested party is whether the litigant can show that he has personally suffered some actual or threatened injury as a result. However, in matter of Baby Boy K, this court also told us that the challenge will ultimately, that the court does not consider, whether the party filing the challenge will ultimately be entitled to any relief, but whether he has a legal right to seek judicial redress for his grievance. I believe much of what the department is trying to argue today is whether the Hansons would be successful, but that is not before this court. What is before this court is whether the Hansons can bring their own petition for adoption through 25-6, and I argue that Judge Hoffman got this right and said they could, which next brings me to the argument of statute construction. As this court had noted in its questions to Mr. Thronson, 25-6-2, 25-6-11 are very clear here. At no point is there any statute that says the department must give consent in order for a party to bring a petition for adoption. This is not the case.
If your view prevails that there is no mandatory consent from the department, do you still, as counsel for the adoptive parents, notify the department that, hey, we've filed a petition for adoption of this child?
Yes, statutorily we must, according to 25.611, provide the department with notification, which we've done so in this action, to let them know so they may appear and object if they so choose.
So they're entitled to appear but not to veto.
Correct. They may present their own evidence as to why they made their recommendation to the court, and at that point, the court, being uniquely qualified to make this determination, can decide, did the department get it right or did they get it wrong? Now, I would argue that if the court is unable to question the department's recommendation, decision, or consent, as Mr. Thronson argues, then there is absolutely no one out there who can question the department. And the danger of essentially streamlining the process is the Ogallala Sioux Tribe case that I brought up in my brief. It's an actual, real, concrete example of the dangers of streamlining and the court deferring to the Department of Social Services and allowing the department to make the determination of best interest instead of the court, which they were vested by the legislature. I would argue that the interpretation of Judge Hoffman was correct in both 25611 and 25062. It does not lead to an unreasonable result. It is not illogical, and therefore the court should confine itself to the plain language of the statute. It is actually the appellant's translation of these statutes which leads us to an unreasonable or illogical result, that being that the department is the ultimate authority on the best interest of children in its department. As I noted in my brief, this creates two separate classes of children. The children in the custody of the department who have no right to review by a neutral third party, and private adoptions that are subject to the jurisdiction and authority and decision-making of the circuit court judge. In reference to Mr. Thronson's argument that there should be a cross-application from the abuse and neglect chapter to the adoption chapter, I would first argue that Mr. Thronson and the department's translation of NRA DM 2, which occurred in 2006, is incorrect. Nowhere in the matter of DM 2 do you find that the judge in that matter, or this court, stated that the great aunt and uncle must proceed through the abuse and neglect statutes. That's false. On the contrary, what this court held was that the Deegans, great aunt and uncle of the child, or relatives who wanted to adopt the child, could not use the intervention statute 268A29.1 when they attempted to intervene through the adoption chapter 25-6 because no such similar right existed in the adoption chapter. Therefore, Mr. Thronson's argument that the court must defer to 268A is false. This court has stated you cannot cross-apply these abuse and neglect statutes to adoption. It does not allow this right. I would also pull through Judge Hoffman's point that 268A29.1 was created, it appears, through the session laws to give priority and organization to relatives who disagreed with the determination of the department's placement if a non-relative was chosen. I think that Session Law 2005, Chapter 140, gives additional clarification on this issue. I believe it was 267A19 was also amended to give relatives some priority here. Obviously, a public policy realization that relatives, when it comes to adoption, should be given some priority or at least the ability to contest a decision of the Department of Social Services. Finally, I would note on this construction argument that Wersima v. Maple Leaf states that it's when the language of a statute is clear, certain, and unambiguous, the court's function is confined to declare its meaning as plainly expressed. Now, Mr. Thronson does state in his brief some additional case law, one being State v. Mundy Gied, the other being Nelson v. SD Board of Dentistry. I would argue that obviously, in State v. Mundy Gied, the public policy argument was that the legislature intended to decriminalize some crimes involving intoxication. However, it was also clear from the legislative history that the state did not intend to decriminalize drinking while driving. So, therefore, the court could look to the legislative history. That's not what we have here. 25611, 25602 are very clear, very unambiguous, and do not lead us to such a result. Next, I would argue to the court, and I believe Judge Hoffman did a great job of utilizing the case of Rodriguez v. Miles, which I understand is a Texas case, but I think the court should consider it in this context because the fact pattern is very similar to what we have at the present, and the Texas code at the time is very similar to the South Dakota law we have today. In Rodriguez v. Miles, we had two competing set of foster families. One had the consent of the department. The Miles did not. The court had the ability statutorily to waive the consent of the department in order to consider the best interest of the child. and the Miles were awarded the adoption of the child. Now, I would note Rodriguez because, as Judge Hoffman adopted, Rodriguez notes that intervention is procedurally distinguishable from bringing a petition for adoption, and I agree. I think there is a large difference between the ability to intervene and bringing a petition for adoption, which the Hansons have done here. I would also note, going back to DM, as Judge Hoffman notes, DM isn't particularly helpful here because in both instances, the Deegans were attempting to intervene, whether that be in the abuse and neglect action or in the adoption action. The court did not address whether the Deegans could have filed their own petition and what would have been the fallout. Further, I would note, I think DM2 is actually helpful to the Hansons in this case because the foster parents brought their own adoption through Chapter 25-6. Now, I understand in Mr. Thronson's brief, he states it is because they had the consent of the department. However, I would note, I don't believe that was factually discussed whether or not there was consent from the department. And this court at that time applied the laws of adoption that we find in 25-6. Now, again, going back to this free-for-all argument, I think it's essentially a public policy argument that brings us back to statute construction. Specifically, utilizing the interpretation of Mr. Thronson of 26-8A would eviscerate 25-6. It would make any reference to children in the care and custody of the department null and void. And this court doing so would essentially destroy an entire chapter that we rely on to bring adoption actions. As Mr. Thronson stated, the department relies on 25-6 after they've had their phone call to determine what's in the best interest of the child. I think it is somewhat frightening as far as the process goes for the department that they have a phone call to make a determination of the best interest of the child, and then that recommended party brings the action to the court, and under the department's translation of those statutes, no one can contest that recommendation.
What was the process in this case that was followed by the department regarding these children?
Thank you, Justice. It's my understanding, and again, I was not counsel during the abuse and neglect statute or abuse and neglect case, so I can't speak to that. What I can say is the Hansons were informed sometime in October 2015, I believe. I have it right here in my notes. October 23rd, 2014, of the placement recommendation by the department.
They didn't participate in the conversation or the phone call?
They did participate in some phone calls and some meetings. However, as I laid out in my factual background in my first brief to this court, originally it appeared that the department was on board that both children would be placed with the Hansons. Only later did the Hansons discover that the department had changed its mind and determined both children should be placed with the Hummelvigs. Now, if given the opportunity, I believe my client would testify that she was informed the decision change came about because the department determined that the biological parents may have additional children, and those children should all be placed together with the Hummelvigs, who do not have any additional foster children beyond BAB. My client's concern is obviously in that sentence, there's no reference to the best interest of the children. We're also dealing with a hypothetical situation regarding children who may or may not ever be born. The Hansons also came to, after speaking with the child's doctor and daycare providers, that they were not interviewed by the Department of Social Services when this recommendation was made. That raised some red flags with my clients. They have adopted before. They've also raised many foster children. They were slightly concerned by the oversight. This was brought to the attention of the department. The department made statements that they would look into it. It didn't appear that they did so. And so, therefore, 25-6 gives the Hansons the perfect platform to present their case to the court and say, Judge, we don't believe the department made the correct recommendation, and this is why. And Judge Hoffman has the unique ability to hear from the department and hear from the Hansons and the Hummelvigs and make a determination as to what is in the best interest of the child. I would also note to this court that, and briefly, that there were some administrative rules cited by Mr. Thronson in his brief. I would note, if the court reviewed the record, the court would determine that this was never addressed by Judge Hoffman on the lower level. There was no reference to 6714, 3217, that the Hansons were entitled to any administrative hearing. So it's the argument of the Hansons that this argument was essentially waived. And further, the Hansons aren't applicants, through the administrative rules.
You have just under 2 minutes.
Thank you, Judge.
Just one before you run out of time here. Since we're kind of a break on the next area, you've moved for attorney fees?
Yes.
And I looked at the section you cited. I don't understand how you are claiming attorney fees or who would pay them.
Justice, I think, and I apologize, I don't have it in front of me.
I don't either at this point, but when I read the motion, I was a little baffled.
And if I may, the issue behind this is, as I stated in the timeline, the department has taken quite a bit of time. There's been very little action. And up until that January 2015, the department took very little action and then filed this appeal, causing my clients to incur quite a bit of additional attorney's fees. Obviously, being foster parents, taking care of these children, they're not in a financial position to wage this legal battle. And it's our position that essentially due to the inaction of the department, a lot of what is in front of the court today may have been resolved. And I don't know if that provides any clarification to your question. Finally, I would conclude that a lot of what Mr. Thronson discusses, whether that be who made the right decision, the process of which the department goes about in order to make their decision, this is a factual dispute. That's not a matter of law. We're here today only to decide whether the Hansons have standing, and I do believe that through 25-6, it's very clear that the Hansons do have standing to bring their petitions. And again, I would reiterate that the question is not whether the Hansons will be successful, but whether they may simply bring the petitions, and I believe that they can. Therefore, I would ask, and I see that I'm out of time. May I finish?
Sure. I just wasn't going to cut you off. You're on a roll.
I would ask if the lower court be affirmed.
Okay. Now I'll cut you off. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Thornton, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
With my 10 minutes, I wanted to just briefly go through and talk about some of the arguments that petitioner provided today. First and foremost, I would like to point out that, you know, this case was one of the law, and it was, as it is now, it was originally with Judge Hoffman in the circuit court hearing. Because of that, there were really no facts that were ever presented in the record. Therefore, I don't think that it's really appropriate for the court to consider all kinds of facts of this case today simply because this case isn't about the facts. It's about the law. And also because the record has really no facts beyond just the very basics, you know, it shouldn't be part of the determination.
It is not part of the determination. I agree, counsel, but isn't that an example of why this needs to go before a court? The only issue is standing. Once the standing is determined, then the court determines the facts on the best interest of the child.
No, Justice Everson, because I don't believe that we even get to that point. Because the issue is, as you mentioned, who has the right to challenge, who basically has standing to come forward and say those are not correct facts or that's not a correct decision. It's the department's determination that outside parties don't have that ability. One thing I want to clarify is that from the beginning, the department in this case has been really painted as just a bunch of bureaucrats who are waving around the law and trying to be above the court, and I would like to say that is not our position. We have never said we are not subject to the court's review, because clearly we are. Under the statutes, the courts have, they retain jurisdiction, they have the ultimate right to approve the adoption. The question is one of who gets to go before the court and say whether that decision is right or not. Now, if the circuit court were to find on its own, decide that they didn't think the department did an adequate job, then certainly they're it's within the court's purview to say that. DSS, you didn't do a good enough job, go back and do it over or consider this, consider that. However, what this does not mean is that under the guise of best interest of the child, the courts can open the doors and let anyone come forward and petition them and say, I don't think DSS got it right. I think it's in a child's best interest to let me plead my case. It's simply not in the children's best interest to do that. I mean, there's a reason why the department is given this role and it's given this responsibility, because we deal with these cases literally thousands of times a day throughout the state. We have thousands of children. Our workers do this every day. We have people who deal with these cases. And I mean,
I want to stop you there, counsel. I hope that nothing that I have said has led you to the view that I deem the department to be nothing but bureaucrats, because that certainly isn't my view.
Yes, I understand.
My view is that they're highly committed, dedicated professionals who are doing their best to serve the children of the state under very hard and difficult circumstances.
Yes, I appreciate it.
And so it's just a question of, will there be any party allowed to petition or intervene or come before the court under the statutory scheme other than the person selected by the department? And what is the role of the trial court? And that's the legal question.
I appreciate that, Justice Kern. Thank you. I think that the law is clear. And if we operate from a position that adoption is a creature of statute, then we must look to the law to say who has that ability. Under the statutes, the only group of people who were given that right by the legislature is relatives. Now, it's true. The legislature could expand that if they wanted to. Certainly, various other states have given foster parents or other people rights. But the issue today, here today in this court, is that at this time, the legislature hasn't done that here. And because of that, petitioners don't have that right. They don't have that ability. I think it's important, again, to note the distinction between intervention and filing your own petition. And the circuit court had ruled that they were distinct, but I'm not so sure that they really are distinct in this case, because really the question boils down to, can a party file an action? Can a party be heard before a court? And if not, or if so, what gives them that right? Now, certainly, I don't think counsel would question, and I don't think the circuit court questioned, that petitioners would not have a right to intervene in the ANN. But I think they would also, for the same reason they can't intervene in the ANN, they also can't file their own petition. They cannot be heard because they have no legally recognized interest in the outcome of these children. Being a foster parent does not grant someone a legal right. Additionally, I would like to point out that, when counsel talks about, it's not a matter of whether they will ultimately prevail in terms of letting them be heard. And I would argue that it does. It could change the outcome a great deal. In this case, for instance, regardless of how this case turns out, because of the amount of time that has gone on, because of the amount of time that this action is taken, regardless, the department will probably have to go back and reassess what is in these children's best interest, because what is in their best interest today or a month from now or 6 months from now may very well not be in what was in their best interest initially. And this is really where the rub comes in, because a party in the petitioner's position don't even necessarily have to be successful to prevail. If they are allowed to simply be heard in court, to delay the proceedings long enough to say, well, the child's already been with us for a year or 2 years, and we can maybe change the department's outcome, I think that is extremely disruptive to the process. It's not good for children, and it makes it extremely difficult for the department to do its job, because essentially anybody could come forward and frustrate our decision in terms of what do we think is in the best interest of a child, and where do we want them to go? And essentially, it doesn't really mean anything, because anybody could come forward and say, I disagree, and I want the opportunity to convince a court that it is, again, that it's not in their best interest. And I think that the relative preference statutes are important for another reason. That is, even though there's no relative in this case, in that even in the case of a relative preference, it's not simply a matter of simple best interest. The statute provides that even with a relative preference, the relative has to prove that the department abused its discretion. So the legislature, the laws, indicate that they do, to some extent, defer to the department's decision. We start on the level that the department is correct, that they use their discretion correctly. However, what petitioners advocate and what the circuit court finds is essentially under the adoption statutes, that presumption goes out the window, that the circuit court doesn't have to presume anything about the department and their abilities. All they simply can say is, I think this other person should have the ability to prove to me that they're a better placement than what the department picked.
And you have just under 2 minutes.
Thank you, Justice. In closing, I just want to say that, you know, the department recognizes that these are really difficult cases, that they're very emotional, and unfortunately, hard decisions have to be made. This is a case where the department had to make a hard decision in keeping with the best interest of these two children. Now, while the department is not unsympathetic to the petitioners, it feels that perhaps this petition is not just a matter of what's in the children's best interest. And because of that, the department still feels that, you know, it should be able to make these decisions and go forward. And I will submit the rest of my time back to the court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thornton. The court will be in recess.